Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Chaim Potok, the author of The Chosen, The Gift of Asher Lev, Davida's Harp, and many other novels, chronicled the life of a Russian Jewish family in his nonfiction work entitled The Gates of November. This true story of the Slepek family, Solomon Slepek, his son Volodya, and daughter-in-law Masha, spans about 100 years. Published in 1996, the story begins with Solomon Slepek's childhood at the beginning of the 20th century, his escape to America, and his return to Russia. It eventually describes Volodya and Masha's life after they apply for an exit visa to leave Russia in 1968 in order to emigrate to Israel. Chaim Potok died on July 23, 2002. When I spoke with him from his home near Philadelphia in January of 1997, we began our conversation with him describing what drew him to trace the Slepek family chronicles.
That's a lengthy story with a number of bumps and ups and downs. I began to hear about the Slepeks in the 1970s, and my wife and I decided to go to the Soviet Union in 1984, and we were there in 1985, and we met them in Moscow. And they had come back recently from 5 years of exile in a tiny village near the border of Mongolia. And the chemistry was perfect among the four of us. We just hit it off right.
The characterization in the prologue to your book of how you met with them is just so precious. I wonder if you could just tell us briefly about that.
Well, we met them in an apartment in Moscow. He didn't even know who we were, because when my wife called him, she didn't identify us. It's not the sort of thing you did on the telephone. And in the course of the evening, he sort of turned to me and asked me if I knew the writer Chaim Potok, because he knew that Chaim Potok lived somewhere in the Philadelphia area, and he knew that we were from the Philadelphia area. So I said, yes, I'm the writer, and he was rather flustered. He thought that somehow I hadn't understood his question. So he asked me again, did I know the writer Chaim Potok? And I said, yes, I'm the writer Chaim Potok. And I pulled out one of those business cards that I had been urged to have made up and carry along with me to the Soviet Union. And when he saw my name on the business card, I was suddenly a person to him. And it was rather a warm and extraordinary meeting of four strangers who were suddenly very close to one another. When we left them that evening, we were sure we would never see them again, and they were sure they'd never get out of the Soviet Union. And a couple of years or so later, they were out. And my agent wondered one evening over dinner in New York if I knew anybody who might be interested in writing their story. And then I said, well, what is their story? And he said there was a tape that Volodya Slepek had made about his story, and it had been translated by his son, and I listened to it. And there was an interesting story there, and I thought, well, spend a year or so writing his story. There were still many, many individuals trying to get out of the Soviet Union who couldn't. And what I would write would be perhaps of help in the growing body of literature of protest that was making an attempt to get these people out. I thought, well, give it a year and so on. I get back to my own work. As I started to write, the Soviet Union opened its doors to these individuals, and suddenly there was no issue. It was gone. And I thought, well, so's the book. The book is gone. Then I thought maybe I would write a more general book about the Soviet Union and dissident movements in the Soviet Union, what that was all about. And suddenly there was no Soviet Union. So that book was gone. And then I thought what I would do is write a history of the Jews of Russia and of the Soviet Union and of the whole Bolshevik movement and the participation of Jews and non-Jews in it, and try to track the growth of the mightiest empires the world has ever seen, and the extent to which these dissidents played a role in that implosion. Could I track one family, a microcosm, and say that the microcosm is somehow representative of things that were going on in a macrocosm among tens and tens of thousands of families at the same time? That was indeed the case, then one might understand more easily the disintegration of the Soviet Union.
In doing that, did you find elements of yourself in the characters that you wrote about, Volodya and Solomon, or some of the other people?
Not really, other than the notion of one generation having significant quarrels with another. I have to say that this was a very different world from the world in which I grew up.
Preparing this book, I wonder how it was different for you than it was in the preparation of The Chosen or The Promise or Davita's Harp.
Well, this book takes the father-son relationship from an altogether different perspective. It's an entirely secular world. And here you have the same father-son tension arising. The difference, of course, was that this is nonfiction. In fiction, when you come to the end of your fact, you can then use your imagination to fill it in, and that's where things really get exciting, when you can use the imagination at the end of the trail of facts. But here, if I come to the end of a trail of facts, I say so, and I don't augment it in any way. This is a work of nonfiction.
Well, in The Chosen, for instance, how much of that is a revelation of your childhood?
Well, the world that I write about is very much my world, but that's fairly typical of modern literature. The writer writing about a certain world very often will use elements of her or his own experience, which he or she then transforms for the sake of fiction. But the starting point is a world that is very familiar to the writer.
Where is that world in your life in Davita's Harp?
That's my wife's world. That was my wife's experience, especially the losing of the prize at the end. That was her experience.
Do you still have the door harp?
Oh, yes, indeed. I have two of them, as a matter of fact.
In the introduction to The Gates of November, you pose two questions that the book seeks to answer. First, what conditions will drive people living in comfort at the very summit of a political system to suddenly turn against that system and bring ruin down on their lives? And second, can a single family serve as a microcosm that might shed light on what ultimately happened to all the peoples of the Soviet Union?
Well, everybody has a map, a model of the world in that space between our ears. It's formed generally in the early years and during the teens. And everything that happens to us is filtered through that model, that construct, that map, that paradigm. In the pre-modern world, that model remained quite firm, quite static, all through one's life. In the modern world, the tendency is for that model to undergo significant transformation. Beginning in the teens, late teens, and often once again in later life, in the 40s and so on. When you live in a hermetically sealed system, such as the Soviet Union was, that map, that model between the ears is formed for you by the culture in which you live. And it's very difficult for it to be altered. The question I set for myself was, here were individuals at the very top of their culture, of their society. And in spite of the fact that they were the elite of that society, that map between the ears changed. How did it change? What were the forces of change? And the change consists of two elements. One, breaking the map. And two, a new map that takes its place. What broke the map, and how did the new map get itself constructed? That was the essential question.
Well, I wonder if, in fact, some of the elements of the map were actually created by Solomon in Volodya's eyes, because as I see it, Solomon returned to Russia because he wanted to live out his ideals. Volodya applied for an exit visa because he wanted to live out his ideals.
Well, that's later, the application for the exit visa. The application for the exit visa comes in the wake of the breaking of the old map and the construction of the new map. That's what I set myself as a goal to understand. Clearly, Volodya's map was constructed for him by his father and by the Soviet state. What changed it?
What changed it?
Well, that's what the book explores. The only way that you can change, I think, a map constructed in a hermetically sealed civilization is if it becomes internally inconsistent. If the system itself seems to be self-contradictory, and those self-contradictory moments are charted very carefully in this book, one being the doctor's plot, the other being Khrushchev's speech in 1956 against Stalin, and the slow building of internal inconsistencies that rendered the map a broken model inside Volodya's head. Then came the problem of what replaces the model, and in fascinating fashion, the conduit for that replacing was a little box called a radio, which he and his few science friends altered to make a shortwave radio, a sort of radio you could buy anywhere in the Soviet Union, but it received only the local broadcast. But they changed its innards, as it were, its coils and its capacitors, so that it could now receive broadcasts from a Voice of America and Radio Liberty, Russian language broadcasts, and the BBC, and the Armed Forces Network, and the Voice of Israel. And slowly, over a period of many, many years, alternate map began to form inside the heads of Volodya and Masha Slepak, consisting of the information that they were getting over this radio.
Was this a conscious search on their part, or were they feeling out for some security and for some intellectual stimulation or something else?
Once that original map began to crack, they made a conscious effort to make a connection to the outside world to see if somehow the outside world might not offer them a different picture of life. They began to feel that what they were getting inside their own world was not the truth, certainly not a truth that they could be comfortable with.
And the crack and the subsequent rupture began with the doctor's plot and Khrushchev's speech about Stalin?
That is correct. The first major crack in their lives started with the doctor's plot, the tirade against Jews in the Soviet press, and the issue with regard to the doctor's plot was that many of the Jewish doctors who were accused and arrested for attempting to poison the upper echelon of Soviet leadership, many of those doctors were colleagues of Masha Slepak, Volodya's wife. She herself was a physician who had studied with some of those doctors. They were her colleagues. And she knew they were innocent. She knew this thing was simply inconceivable. It's one thing when something is happening and you're distanced from it. It's another thing entirely when it's happening, you're right in the middle of it, and you know the people involved. You know how absurd the thing is.
But she herself was not accused.
She was not accused, but she was very close to those who were. And when she told Volodya about this, and the two of them confronted the old man, Volodya's father, about this, he told them it's worth jailing 1,000 people, and even if 999 of them were innocent, if they find the one who's guilty, it's still worth killing the thousand. And at that point, he and Baloja had an enormous row. And that was the first of many quarrels that they had. And it was that doctor's plot, which is what that issue has come to be called, the arrest of the doctors that began to take place at the end of 1952 and continued early into 1953, and then came to an end when Stalin died in March 1953. And very soon afterwards, in April, the doctors that had been arrested were all freed, and the announcement came that the arrest was illegal.
Why were the Russians and the KGB so hostile to the Jewish people and subsequently to the Refuseniks and the dissidents?
Well, much of this goes back to the very beginnings of Russian history. Sometime around the year 900 or so, the tribes that had come down from the north, which are generally called the Rus tribes, R-U-S, or a tribe called the Rus, settled originally around Kiev, that tribe adopted Greek Christianity, which became Russian Christianity, Byzantine Christianity. And adopting it, they also adopted the attitude of Byzantine Christianity or Greek Christianity toward the Jews, which was, to say the very least, hostile. The Jews were regarded as the eternal other, a demonic people whose essential purpose it was to corrupt and destroy Christendom. That pure, unalloyed anti-Semitism became part of the very fabric of Russian culture. Now, it was to some extent part of the fabric of Western culture as well, except the West had two ameliorating experiences that thinned out that attitude toward the Jew. It attenuated it. One was the Renaissance, and the other was the Reformation, which left a spectrum of attitudes toward the Jew in Western culture. But Russia never experienced the Renaissance, and Russia never experienced the Reformation. So when the Kievan Rus disintegrated as a state, sometime in the about 1200, 1300, under the onslaught of the Mongols, and then the next state became the Russian or Muscovite state, they simply inherited that culture. And it thrived all the way through. There were no Jews in Russia until about 1795, 1796, when Russia conquered parts of Poland and inherited suddenly half a million or more Jews, which about a century or so later ended up being close to 5 million. And they never knew what to do with their Jews. The attitude toward the Jews was they were simply a horrific people, and we wish they would just go away. Now, with the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, this softened considerably and remained softened for about 10, 15 years. And then with Stalin, especially toward the end of Stalin's life, that old Russian attitude toward the Jew began to surface. And the anti-Semitism became very much a part of the Soviet agenda and came boiling to the surface with the doctor's plot, that old medieval notion of the Jew as poisoner. And Masha found herself right in the middle of this because she herself was a doctor.
Do you feel that the shaping or of Solomon's life and the softening, as you describe it, under Lenin's time, had an effect on Solomon's remaining the old Bolshevik to the end and standing by the government, turning his back on his son when he said, "I want an exit visa"?
Oh, yes. Solomon was one of a fairly small handful of Jews, about 2,000 indeed, who were active Bolsheviks in a party of about 100,000 or more, who really felt that the Bolshevik dream was to improve mankind. And when they became part of the revolution, they became committed dreamers par excellence, feeling that the Bolshevik dream was the only way, once and for all, to change the world. You uprooted the old aristocracy, you uprooted the old corrupt bourgeoisie, and in its place you put a regime, a world run by common, ordinary people. And they hoped that this new world would once and for all do away with anti-Semitism. And indeed, in the early years of the Bolshevik Revolution, Lenin could not be called an anti-Semite in any ordinary sense of the term. He simply felt that the Bolshevik was a Bolshevik with no ties to any particular group. And the early Jewish Bolsheviks were totally committed to the dream of the revolution. It was later that that dream became corrupted, especially during the time of Stalin. Old-style anti-Semitism simply came back to the surface of the Russian world.
Let me take a moment and say that I'm talking with Chaim Potok from his home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, about his book entitled The Gates of November, The Chronicles of the Slepak Family. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Chaim, in the luck, if luck is the right word, is that what you feel saved Solomon's life so many times from not being executed shortly after he returned to Russia and threw on out his life in his many different involvements? Or was there a closer connection that he had that sustained itself with the Russian government?
Well, that's one of the ongoing mysteries throughout the book that I tried to explore. And indeed, I'm still trying to find out how he escaped all those purges. Everybody around him was picked up. He was certainly a visible entity. He was deputy head of the foreign desk of TASS. He was preparing briefing books for Stalin and the members of the Politburo. And all around him, people were being picked up and shot. A number of individuals inside TASS preferred to shoot themselves rather than be arrested. And he somehow eluded arrest. And I'm not sure how that happened, and neither is anyone in the family certain as to how that happened. There are all kinds of conjectures. He may have slipped through the bureaucratic cracks, but for that to have happened over and over again is, to say the least, unlikely. He may have been lucky, as you put it, but nobody was really that lucky. He may have had something on somebody. We're not sure, and that's what I say in the end. We're not sure. I'm still trying to get into his KGB files. So far, they're still closed.
I'd like to ask you, as we come to the close of our program, to read the section of your book where the Slepak's life was transformed.
Well, now, this part takes place after years of listening to the Voice of America, after years of listening to Voice of Israel, BBC, Radio Liberty, Armed Forces Network, after the doctor's plot, after Khrushchev's speech in 1956, after the map has changed, and there's a moment where they have to make a decision about what to do with their lives.
Did they realize that moment was going to be there that day? Maybe you should answer that by reading the passage.
The moment took place in 1968, December 25th, in a Moscow apartment. Of friends of theirs, they had a small circle of friends that they were a part of, Volodya and Masha. That circle met, and they met with a number of people who were leaving for Israel soon, especially one individual who was going the next day. And that individual had told them that if they were to give him their family data, he would take that with him to Israel, and the process would begin for getting them exit visas. And they knew that once they gave that data and the Israelis responded, that the KGB would monitor their mail and find out, and their lives would never be the same again. Volodya Slepak was in a top position as a scientist. He was one of those responsible for the air defense system of the Soviet Union. And Masha Slepak was a leading physician in one of the top hospitals in Moscow. and their lives would never be the same again. Religious Slaypak had security clearance just below those members of the Politburo, just below Stalin.
And he lost all of that security.
Of course he did. The passage is as follows. Now, in the Drapkin's apartment, the circle of friends talked with six people from Riga, among them a man named Mark Bloom in his late 20s, who was not returning to Riga because he was unmarried and had no family there. Instead, he was to leave for Israel shortly via Vienna. Did anyone in the group wish to give him the personal data needed by the Israelis in order for them to send the official invitations that were necessary for Soviet visa applications? Name, addresses, children, dates of birth, names of parents, relatives in Israel. He would give the information to the Israelis, who would then search for the relatives. In cases of a total absence of relatives, the Israeli authorities would look into the possibility of other arrangements. Members of the group began to write down the information. Volodya and Masha sat looking at each other. It was late evening. The curtains were drawn against the winter gloom outside. Masha got to her feet and took Volodya's hand, and they moved to a dark corner near a window and a desk and stood with their backs to the others. Masha said quietly, "This is a special opportunity. Who knows when it might happen again? Are you ready to do it?" Volodya, lost in fearful hesitation, did not respond. Fighting back her apprehension about the consequences of their act upon their children, Masha said, "We must use this opportunity." And Volodya, after a brief silence, said, "Let's do it," and felt they had suddenly fallen into deep and icy waters.
Hi, I'm Potok. I want to thank you very much for joining us at Radio Curious. Before we close, could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
The English Patient, significant novel.
Hi, I'm Potok. Thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
You're very welcome.
Hi, I'm Potok is the author of The Gates of November. The book that he recommends is The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.